And I will mute all. And with that, I will turn it over to Alan to lead us through tonight's deck.
Thank you, Chris, and welcome everybody. Chris said, for the last of the year. And we have quite a number of different topics tonight, so I hope you'll find something of interest. We'll start off with a follow-up from last week. I talked a little bit about dispetitioning at the end of the session, and I was throwing acronyms around, and Bob Harris pointed out that he wasn't sure what some of them were. So I thought it might be useful just to go over these things relatively quickly. So if you think first of all about dispetitioning, there's really kind of two types in general usage. One is MBR, which is the master boot record. And it's an older dispetitioning scheme which came about in the DOS days, but it's still fairly widely used. One of the downsides is it's really limited to a 2 terabyte partition, which in these days with these huge hard drives we have, that's not an awful lot necessarily. And as Tom mentioned, it only supports 4 primary partitions. And normally you'd have probably a system or a recovery partition, which would be set by the manufacturer. And I think that's usually set as a primary partition. And then you'd have a C drive, the Windows drive, the operating system and the applications. That would definitely be a primary partition because it's bootable. And then people like me, and as we talked about last week, you can partition the drive and create a 3rd partition, which again can be a primary one. And I use that as a dedicated data drive. And then I want to dual boot my system into Linux. And to do that, I need a partition for Linux. I need another partition for swap space, which is counting. That would give me 5 partitions, which is a problem. But fortunately, MBR allows you to have an extended partition. And so you can actually have the 3 primary partitions, which would be the system, the C drive, and the data partition. And then you can have this extended partition, which then allows you to have virtual disk drives. So Linux goes onto one of these virtual drives, and the swap partition, the swap space, takes the other one. And you can have more and more of logical partitions, of course, in that extended partition. So it's a fairly flexible system, albeit old and somewhat limited in terms of capacities these days. And that's where GPT comes in. And GPT is the GUID partition table scheme. Clearly this is a newer partitioning process. And the GPT comes from GUID, which is a globally unique identifier. So every disk these days, every partition rather, has a globally unique identifier, which the operating system can use to decide which disk is which. It's still somewhat size limited, but that's determined by the operating system you use and the file system which has been adopted. So for example, Windows in GPT supports up to 128 partitions on any given disk. And each of those partitions can be up to 256 terabytes, which is probably big enough for most people's hard drives these days. And the actual raw limit in terms of storage capacity on the disk is absolutely enormous. It's 9.4 zettabytes. And zettabytes, if you think about it, we're used to gigabytes, and we're probably used to terabytes. But after terabytes, you've got petabytes, and after petabytes, you've got exabytes, and after exabytes, you've got zettabytes or zettabytes. So each of these is going up by a factor of 1,000, so you can see that 9 zettabytes is an awful lot of bytes. I don't think anybody can afford the drive that takes those on a personal basis anyway, so it's probably not really a problem. The more useful thing is that this is quite a robust partitioning scheme because it keeps multiple copies of things like partition tables and boot records on the drive. So if one gets damaged, it has a backup that it can try and recover the information from. Once you've got a partitioning scheme which tells the operating system how the disk is kind of organized, then you have to tell it how the file system works. And again, there are two primary, in the Windows world anyway, two primary file systems. One is the file allocation table, FAT. And right now we're mostly using FAT32, which is an upgrade from the old DOS FAT16. These are 16 and 32-bit file systems, basically. And FAT32 you may recognize as being pretty standard because if you have an external flash drive, almost certainly it came at least with a FAT32 format. The thing is, it gives you more efficient storage because it reduces the cluster size. So you can have more clusters, smaller files don't take as much disk space. And it also gives you the option to use long file names, which Windows uses. It is limited, and by default, it's limited to files of 4 gigabytes. And that sounds like a lot, but if you're using disk images and disk imaging programs, and you're creating one disk image file for your whole hard drive, that could be compressed by, say, 50%, but you could still have like a 40 or a 50 gigabyte file. So it's not very convenient to have that on a FAT32 system, because what it will do is it will split the file up into 10, 20 different portions. Now, all that will be handled automatically, but it's messy when you start looking at the file system and you want to see where your backup files are located. So generally, you'd use a big hard drive, an external USB drive, and you'd probably format that to NTFS to get around that problem. And so you're limited to 4 gig files and 2 terabyte disk partitions. Now you can have bigger file and partition capacities if you use extended FAT or XFAT, and that will let you go beyond those limitations. One of the other issues is that, or not really an issue, but a positive side is that FAT32 is highly compatible across file systems, across operating systems. So for example, Linux knows all about FAT32 and flash drives without doing anything special. So if you think about the second one, which is NTFS, and this is a Windows system, new technology file system. It first came out in 93 when Windows released their Windows NT operating system. And the benefits are that it gives you much bigger file and disk sizes. So you can have 16 terabyte files and 8 petabyte disk partitions, depending on how you set up the file system and the cluster size. NTFS is a much more secure file system. It lets you do file permissions, for example, so you can make files read-only, for example. You have system files, so you can't delete them accidentally. And it's also more robust. They say it's self-correcting or a journaling. It's a journaling file system. So basically, when changes are made to files, it records the changes in a database, a journal. And that allows the operating system itself to try and do some error correction if anything gets corrupted. And the downside is it's less transportable. I'm not sure whether, for example, Apple systems can read NTFS files natively, but Linux actually can. There's a piece of software in Linux that you can hook in and that will let you access NTFS files relatively easily. So that's basically my 5 minutes worth, 10 minutes worth maybe, on partitioning and file system technologies. Right, my next item is a follow-up to the issue I was talking about last week with my smartphone, where this browser metrics folder was eating up 1 gigabyte of my my email client's file system. I cleaned that out and the problem went away, but then I suddenly noticed that I'm losing all kinds of disk storage again. And sure enough, there were some 100 megabytes in my K9 browser metrics. But then when I looked at that disk map that I showed, where I used a File Explorer to create a disk map of my phone, I found there was a whole raft of applications which were creating these browser metrics folders, and they all had 100, 200 megabytes of junk in. And of course, once you start doing that, it adds up relatively quickly. So I hadn't had a chance to check what was going on in terms of updates to my my custom ROM and so on. But I did try and find out what this browser metrics thing was all about. And when I did that, I found this posting on GitLab, who he was complaining about exactly the same thing, that all kinds of apps were creating garbage in this app WebView browser metrics folder, which never got deleted. And then just 2 days ago, the bottom posting there says, this is going to be resolved by any builds dated after the 27th of December. And Lineage OS is the basis, at least, for the custom ROM I'm using. So I imagine that the January build will solve this problem for me. So again, that's another plus for open source software. People find problems and programmers actually fix those problems. Okay, another share. We've been talking quite a bit in the last couple of weeks about speech to text using Gboard, Google Keyboard, and keyboard systems in general in Android that support microphone input. I remembered that Micheline had posted on the user forum a long time ago a note that Windows 10 now supports dictation. And I'd made a note of it. And just last week, I followed up and found the article that describes what's going on. And it turns out it's pretty simple. And all you need to remember is the Windows key, which is that bottom left-hand corner next to Control, and H. So if you hold the Windows key down and hit H, it will basically pop up a window in a program that's accepting typing, like Microsoft Word, for example, and suddenly you have the ability to dictate. So I thought, well, that's good enough. I have to try that out. So I set up some text. And this is just the first two sentences of a small paragraph that I used, and I've written a little newsletter article which will appear in due course. So for the full-blown text and my detailed analysis, you'll have to read the newsletter article. But basically, I used Microsoft Word and I used Android's Writer Plus, right? Because I thought Windows would know about Word and Android might know about Writer Plus. And then the rest of this paragraph is essentially related to the weather, because everybody talks about the weather, so you should know about sunny days and snow. So first thing I did was go to my phone and use Google Keyboard, and this is the text, the transcription of the text. And you may note as you're reading this that there are basically two errors. It decided that I had said, and I say, I didn't make any attempt to do any kind of training, voice training of either system, and I didn't attempt to read this text is being, I just tried to read in a normal voice at a normal pace. So Android saw Android's Writer Plus instead of Writer plus. And the other interesting thing is it saw when I said period after plus, but it didn't start the next line, the next sentence with a capital letter. Although after weather, it did, right? It's got weather period, and then it starts off with a capital T this. So that did a pretty creditable job. Maybe I should be a bit more careful when I say writer plus. And this is what happened when I dictated it into Microsoft Word. And you can see at the bottom there, there's the Word listening when I hit the Windows key plus H key. And Windows didn't quite do as well, I would say. It got all the weather stuff fairly well, but and it liked Microsoft Word. It got the capitalization right, interesting enough. But it saw hand instead of and it said writer plus instead of writer plus. And hey, common point of discussion, not a common point of discussion. And the way that this could involve, I have. This could involve either, I said. Anyway, not too bad, but not great. Anyway, read the newsletter article. But just remember that key combination, Windows key and H, and you can try dictating into Windows 10 apps all by yourself. Okay. First question of the night. Hala says her mum is 88 and has no experience with computers. She's hoping to find a way to do video chats with relatives, and do we have any suggestions? And Chris and I threw this about a little bit, and we decided that probably, why not an Android tablet? Android tablets have a few advantages. They have a fairly large screen. They're relatively inexpensive, $70, $150 and up. And it turns out it's really easy to set up video conferencing. And for an elderly person, it's incredibly simple to use because you've got a touch screen. So you just have to follow the bouncing ball. And of course, because it's Linux, because it's Android, it just works. And it really does. So connecting is fairly simple. I couldn't get it to connect on my browser, but there is a Zoom client. And by installing the Zoom client, which was trivial, so it's easy to set up your tablet to do this. And then basically, you just have to click on the link that somebody sends you by email. It asks you for a name. It remembers your name, so that next time you just have to hit OK, and then wait for the host to let you in, and bingo, you're in. So here's my test. I sent myself an email with a link. I told it my name. I hit OK. It says, wait until they let you in. And zingo, you probably recognize this is my classic sharing a screen and sharing a video point, a PowerPoint presentation and a little notepad. No, that's LibreOffice Writer with some text on it. So really easy to do. Anyway, Chris has some more follow-up to the follow-up.
Yeah, it was a late-breaking addition to it all in that I got an email saying that, oh, and by the way, I need a device for which you can add a data plan because elder parent didn't have internet access. So that's no small addition to this requirements. So vast majority of the devices out there of tablets and things like that, they're designed for Wi-Fi only. But there are some that do allow you cellular access. And there's one example there of a Galaxy Tab that does have, I think it's LTE access. So you can buy a cellular plan through a provider and buy a tablet that will allow you to connect it directly. The problem with doing that, though, I think, is the operational costs, which can get really high if you're not on Wi-Fi. So data requirements for Zoom largely run around the 1.6 gigabytes per hour. So if we assume that this is going to be, say, 4 gigabytes a month doing video calling with this elder parent, let's just go with that for our numbers. So option one, if your device has a cellular connection capability, you buy a plan and you connect up. Rogers, Bell, and Telus all have unlimited data plans for $75 a month. You can get cheaper plans if you're willing to limit the amount of data. So Virgin Mobile, Kudu, and Fido, they all have $45 a month plans for 4 gigabytes of data. Fizz and Public Mobile have $40 a month plans for 5 gigabytes of data. Keep in mind that if you go with a limited data plan, you better watch the data, because once you go into overages, the costs skyrocket really, really quite quickly. So an option two is to get just a regular internet access, and then connect a tablet or a computer over Wi-Fi rather than buying that data plan for the tablet. And from National Capital Freenet, for $36 a month, you can get 6 megabit per second down and 0.8 megabit per second up. That may be a little bit limited. So you're scraping the edge, I think, on 0.8 megabit per second up. 6 megabit per second down should be fine. But NCF can also sell you $42 a month for 15 megabit per second down and 10 megabit per second up. A lot of this depends on, you know, how far you are from Bell's central office and things like that. But these are all up to. But if you can get 10 megabit per second up, you know, that's plenty of bandwidth for it. And you get unlimited bandwidth, so you don't have to worry about overage charges. And it's cheaper than going with the cellular plan. Fido, Storm, and Tech Savvy all have plans around $64 to $69 a month. For 75 megabit per second down and 10 megabit per second up. And all of those are unlimited bandwidth. So I think option two is the best, to actually put in an internet connection and you get unlimited bandwidth. And it's about the same ongoing costs as getting only 4 to 5 gigabytes cellular. So you don't have to worry about going the overages. It's about, you know, getting around the half the price if you're going with unlimited on either Bell, Rogers, or Telus. So it's nice to not have to limit to just video conferencing, so you can use that connection for other things. You can get that unlimited bandwidth available on the cellular, but it's going to be about twice the cost of option two. Very easy to have multiple devices, whereas if you're connecting your tablet directly to it, it gets a little bit more finicky to have multiple devices that are using that connection. And then you're also going to have to worry about going over data plans and things like that. And a big thing is that you get a much wider choice of devices that you can purchase in terms of tablets or small laptops or things like that, that you could use for this video conferencing solution. So personally, I think option two is the best way going forward, but you know, there is the both ways of doing it.
So Tom has a couple of things in the chat. Caritel also good for internet access, and Telus he thinks has a senior low income plan. And Ollie notes that there's an organization called Connected Canadians who specialize in giving seniors tech support.
Oh, that's a good idea, yeah. One thing I'll point out, too, is that NCF does have a low-income plan as well, but it is on the lower. I think it only caps out at the 0.6 megabit per second upload, and so it's only on the slower speeds that you can get that less expensive plan. I didn't try to do an all-exhaustive search. I just did some, you know, the major players and some of the ones that popped up when I said, you know, Cheap Internet Ottawa, and went through the first couple of names that I recognized. So certainly it's worth shopping around to see if you can get a better deal. But there's at least the deals that I listed, which I think still brings option two as being the best of the two.
So does anybody have any thoughts about some other kind of device? I mean, we said Android tablets, but one of the other things Howard mentioned was a Chromebook. But not having any experience with Chromebooks, I went with the Android tablet. It works very well. And I think Linda said that she has no problem with, oh, I think that was dictation, sorry.
Yeah, Lawrence says Chromebook if you want more laptop-like experience. Yeah, I was thinking that, or a cheap laptop, but I think in terms of, you know, an elderly parent, a tablet is probably the simplest device to give them, yeah, I would think.
That's my thinking. It avoids the keyboard, which is maybe a downside for older people, older than us, older than me.
Yeah, right.
Okay, let's move along then. Another question from... another question from Hala, actually. Has a Toshiba Tekra R850 laptop, which is given an error message for the webcam, camera not attached. It doesn't appear in Device Manager. She tried the suggestions given by Windows Troubleshooter, but it didn't work. Never seen this problem. I don't have a Toshiba laptop, but certainly there's lots of people on the web have the same similar problems. And one of the things in the Microsoft forum suggested that there are multiple fixes for the camera app. And you could go into the settings and try resetting the camera app. Another thing, the privacy settings have to be such that apps are allowed to use the webcam. So clearly, I don't know whether that generates that error message, but it's not going to work if the webcam's disabled. Updating the webcam's driver, I would think the troubleshooter would tell you about that. And if the problem was recent, then is it a Windows update problem? Maybe you could try rolling back the Windows update. And there were a few other things on the web that, you know, I don't know, she said she tried the troubleshooter, but I don't know whether she's gone through more fixes that have been suggested on the web. And then Chris had the ultimate solution, right, Chris?
Oh, was it me who came up with this one? I don't remember. It was a Toshiba laptop. So I think, yeah, one of the things I said is, like, contact Toshiba and ask them. They should know if there's, you know, known issue with recent versions of Windows or whatever workarounds that they have. Certainly worth trying contacting the manufacturer and seeing what they have to say. We pay a lot for that. I've said this before. We pay a lot for our software and our hardware, and we shouldn't put up with the crap that a lot of the vendors try to push on us and just say, oh, well, that's the way it is. You know, complain.
Except Tom's pointing out that this is a really ancient computer.
That's fine.
So maybe if you uninstall the driver and reload it, revert to a previous driver, and download the driver from Toshiba. But basically, he says a new laptop.
Well, I agree it might be necessary, but the thing is, there's the old adage about, you know, if you're banging your head against the wall, it really helps to stop. And so if Toshiba says, no, it just doesn't work in version whatever of Windows, and it's not going to work, then stop banging your head against the wall and just say, okay, I'll live without a webcam. I'll add a webcam to it that I can plug into one of the USB ports, or I'll wait until I get my next laptop.
Yeah, in fact, Lawrence is saying he's done a lot of research on cameras, and when they die, it's only a hardware repair that will fix it. And Tom had suggested just buying a webcam, like you say, an external webcam, fairly cheap, and that's a reasonable fix if you can do that.
Yeah.
Anyway, those are all good possibilities. Okay, next up, Stuart had a question about Secunia PSI. Chris.
Yeah, okay. Let me just paste in the latest one. Okay, so a little bit of background on this. There was a PSI, Personal Software Inspector, was a product put out for free for personal use by Secunia. Secunia got bought up by Flexera, and Flexera, after a couple of years, decided that they were only going to support the corporate software inspector, CSI, and they were dropping Personal Software Inspector. A couple of the ex-Secunia employees decided that they were going to pick up and run with this, and they formed this organization, or I'm not sure if they're under the umbrella of, or they formed Sectier, but they came up with this product called Vulndetect. And so they promised that it was going to have, final release was going to be out 6 months later, which was about a year and a half ago. So it was launched in the spring of 2018. I was looking through their blog, and the beta designation was actually removed August 20th of 2020. Now, I don't see any significant difference in the app itself. I've been using it for probably over a year now. And, the website, it has a very beta look to it still. And so there's no lovely, user guide. It's really, a rough looking thing, but it actually functions. So next there. Okay. So what I like about it is that it is free. Okay. And it does seem to work properly, but there's some things I don't like. You have to do a manual check. So it won't pop up and tell you that, oh, okay, you've got some software that has got security vulnerabilities for which a patch is available. So you have to actually just run an app. I haven't seen any way around this. And it will tell you, it's actually checking in the background. So by default, I think it checks every day, or you can certainly schedule it within the app itself to actually check every day. You have to go into the app and it'll actually tell you at that point, it's the last run, what software you have that is vulnerable. So I would like automatic notification, but so far it's not there. So yeah. Okay. Go ahead. Yeah. So here's the app. It actually loads as a web page. So this is what would show up when you actually double click the icon for Sectier Vulndetect. It'll open up in the web browser looking like this. There's two tabs. There's applications, and that's the main one. And it'll tell you that, what apps you have have security vulnerabilities. And So if you happen to have an older version of the agent that is running on your computer, there will be a banner across the top that says, oh, you can update to the latest here. Insecure apps float to the top of the list, and so you can see ones with the tag beside them saying that they're insecure. And there is an icon where you can download an app to do an update. Notice that you can expand out any of the individual items in the list, and it tells you what the recommended version is and who it's by and where the app is actually running from on your computer, and there's a link there as well for open product page. Notice that on the Intel Extreme Tuning Utility that I didn't have a download update app, icon. So for some reason, they don't know how to do the download for that. I thought this was a really kind of a curious one as well, because the Intel Extreme Tuning Utility is only applicable if you have a version of a core processor that allows you to overclock. And I don't have a version that actually allows me to overclock. So I'm not even sure why this is on my computer. But anyway, it was just curiosity. The other tab is configuration, and this is where you can go in. You can tell it when you want it to run, and it'll tell you when it last checked in with Vulndetect website. Tells you when the last inspection of your computer was, when it'll check in next, and when the next inspection will be happening. And then there are checkboxes so you can have it run, every day is the default, I guess, because I never changed it. And so it actually does check once a day. There is a checkbox there, and it's not selected by default. Allow Vulndetect to update applications. I don't like, especially with a program that seems as raw as this program seems to be, I don't allow it to do updates for me. So I'll use it, and I'll look at it, and I'll decide if I'm going to update or not individual applications, and I'll just do it manually. And I think that was it for there. Okay, we have a question.
Tom had said, don't forget zero patch. It must be another similar kind of utility.
Okay. Yeah, I haven't heard of that.
And Natalie is asking if there's a difference between this program and the vulnerability scan, which is built into Kaspersky.
Well, certainly there would be. It's a different program. The idea behind them is the same. With Kaspersky, I believe that the update of security vulnerabilities is not free, which is one of the charms of this program. And having been developed by the people who actually came up with Personal Software Inspector, I thought that was a wonderful program. It doesn't seem to be coming quite up to snuff of the capabilities of it, but still, it's not bad. But yeah, the aim of the program would certainly be the same as built into any of the other security suites that are out there.
So Chris, this vuln detect, does it basically flag the same kind of issues that Secunia used to?
Yeah, it's looking only for programs that have a security vulnerability for which a patch is available.
Okay, so it's really just all the toys being able to self-update and that kind of thing which are missing.
Yeah.
I never used those anyway, so it would actually, I didn't realize it was now live, as it were, so I'll have to go and load it.
Yeah, I mean, it seems to be innocuous. It's, as I say, you do have to remember to actually go into the program periodically and see if it's found anything, because it won't pop up and tell you, which was one of the nice things about PSI, was that you would actually get a pop-up telling you that you had things that needed attention. So
Zero Patch is actually complementary to this. It actually covers things like Windows and other major programs. Okay. And it basically fixes minor problems that it can fix in those programs without having to update the programs. For example, it supports, it puts in different security patches in Windows 7.
Okay, cool.
Okay, moving on to the next question, I think. This is Natalie using Windows 10 and Windows Media Player, and puts in a CD or a DVD and has to start the player manually. So Chris has a bunch of suggestions.
Yeah, so this is kind of interesting because Windows has autoplay capabilities. Yeah, I think this was your slide, Alan. It was that, So basically everything is defaulting to take no action. And it's important to realize that Microsoft used to default to auto-playing CDs and DVDs. The reason why they changed this is because there was a circulation of a bunch of malware on CDs and DVDs that as soon as you pop that in, it would actually run on your computer. So you have to be aware of the fact that Microsoft changed this default for security reasons. However, if you're interested, you can actually change this action.
And Tom is noting that this is good because it gives you better security and also applies to USBs.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Okay. So if you go into the Settings app, which is where all things configurable in Windows is supposed to be now, and you go to Devices Autoplay, and for removable drive, you can end up, go back one there.
Sorry.
Yeah, so on removable drive, you see you have the default of take no action. You can open a folder to view the files. You can ask every time what to do, or you can configure storage settings, which I don't know what storage settings would have to do with autoplay. So no help there. However, if you actually go and you just go to the search bar in Windows and you type in CDs, you'll see it pop up saying play CDs or other media. You can also put in DVDs and it'll come up saying that too. So if you click on that, it will actually run Control Panel, which you would think by now they would have moved everything from Control Panel over to Settings, but they haven't. And then here, it'll actually bring up a long list of things that can be autoplayed in Windows. And so you could go to, for example, on this one here, I went to Audio CD, and I said choose the default, and it has. I'll play Audio CD using VLC, which I have installed on my computer, or play Audio CD using Windows Media Player, which Microsoft would love you to use their program instead, or you get the Take No Action, or Open Folder, or Ask Every Time. So you have all those options on those different things for CDs and DVDs. So you can set those options if you want. But again, I caution that there is, I think, good reason why Microsoft stopped autoplay on CDs. But if you trust every CD or optical disc that you put in your computer, then you can set it to do an autoplay.
I did that, and it didn't work.
Through control panel here?
Yeah, I did it with the CD, and it did not play it.
That's interesting. I didn't actually try it because I don't want it to.
I loaded my CD, and it sort of it read it, and then it just shut down. Like, it just didn't play it. I had to manually start it.
Yeah, interesting. I'll try later on my computer, but the only thing I can think of is that maybe Microsoft didn't get around to removing it from control panel, even though they left it there, but they removed the code to actually allow the autoplay to function. That's the only thing I can think of that maybe has happened. Maybe they thought it was so dangerous that they thought, no, we're not going to let you do it, but they haven't gotten around to fixing control panel, maybe.
Okay.
I don't know. Has anybody else on the call? Does anybody else use autoplay for audio CDs, and does it work for you?
Does anyone still use audio CDs?
There you go. Well, yeah. But it should work with playing of a DVD as well.
Yeah, I did both. I tried the CDs, I tried the DVDs, nothing.
That's interesting. Anybody else? I don't see anybody else chiming in that they've had success with it or that they've been able to duplicate your issue. I'll take another crack at it. But
mine works perfectly. I'm in Tom's camp. I've just turned it off. It works perfectly every time.
Yes. Yeah, right.
So Lawrence had a question here while we're thinking about it. Will Microsoft really be able to replace Control Panel completely?
Of course they can.
Why not, Lawrence?
Yeah, it's just code. God, all they have to do is build a user interface for it. They have to build a page in the Settings app that includes all of the options that are in Control Panel, and they can get rid of Control Panel. They've been slowly getting rid of it for, about 4 years now.
Exactly. Four years for something that, as you say, should have been done.
Exactly. Every feature release that comes out migrates more things from Control Panel. And it's getting pretty close now. There's not too much stuff you have to go there. But there's still some annoying things that, you still have to go to Control Panel. It's crazy.
And the frustrating thing about it is that you're trying to remember which is which. And then you only need to find out that regardless of setup, saying, oh, yes, no, we've got it. And then you finally get into the window that you need to go into to configure something. And, hey, guess what? It's the old control panel interface. Ta-da! After 5 minutes of going through all that, you get what you would have gotten out of control panel in the first place, still to this day.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that I think they actually did an okay job of is that if you hit the search box in settings and you type in something there, it'll give you results from control panel as well. So at least that they don't totally hang you out to dry. They will give you, a link from settings, over into control panel, but I don't understand at all why they haven't completed the migration after all this time.
By the way, you don't have to worry about control panel or settings. You can just use God mode.
Well, you're still in the position where there are some things that are only in settings. And you're getting more and more things that are only in settings.
I haven't checked, but I think God mode covers settings as well as control panel.
I thought it was only control panel applets that it called. I don't know. I'll have to look at that as well. But, God mode is it's a bit of a pain, I find, too, because it's such a long list that will come up in God mode. Jeez.
You can search, though. You just have to put in the what you want at the top, and it'll search for you automatically.
Yeah.
Oh, it's nice to hear all you satisfied Windows users. All right, let's go back to Android and share from Stuart. Everybody likes free apps that make our smartphones sing and dance, and sometimes they're even worth paying for, he says. Yes. However, sometimes we don't get what we want, and we want our money back. And here's a link to official Google information on how to get refunds. So anybody who wants to get refunds of apps they paid for, there's a useful link, maybe.
It's actually useful to go and read that before you need it, because it has a lot of the caveats about, you know, what are the conditions under which you can actually get a refund, and what are time limits, how do they come into play, and things like that. So if you're in the habit of buying anything from the Google Play Store, I highly recommend that you check this out before you need it.
Alas, Amazon and eBay give you 30 days, but I don't think the Play Store gives you quite as much.
No. But it does vary.
So try before you buy, right?
Yep.
Okay, so here's another satisfied Windows customer. 2 weeks he's had problems with Windows 10. This is Orion. He gets an error code system image backup error and a very interesting message. The semaphore timeout period has expired. How interesting. And the web suggests a number of fixes, including a new restore point, maybe. And after 4 or 5 tries, he can get a complete backup. Any more suggestions? Well, Chris has more suggestions.
Yeah, well, I think it's time for a change. I just sent this in an email to Alan. He just put it in verbatim into here. Given the vast attention Microsoft has given to continued development of a flexible, comprehensive backup solution, move on. Go to something that is actually a good free imaging solution. And I wrote about my last search for a backup program a couple of years ago, and I wrote it in the for the newsletter. So you can read about 4 backup programs and how I compared them. And you know, what my conclusions were. They were all, I thought, good programs. There was one that stood out for me, but a different one may stand out for you. But they're all free of charge. Try them out. They're all quite full-featured programs, and they all seem to work very, very well.
And I don't use Windows Backup, but I wondered if you could just junk everything that you've done so far and start afresh, whether that would actually work. But I agree with Chris. I much prefer the third-party products. They work really well.
And yes, and Lawrence, that is sarcasm, Lawrence.
No, we don't do sarcasm.
I wonder when Microsoft might finally admit to the fact that they just don't want to do backup.
They've not got a very good track record in terms of their software. So here's a question from Martin. He listened to Lawrence on December the 9th. I think that must have been a library session, maybe. Anyway, talking about range extenders. And before he installed his new TP-Link range extender, he thought he'd check the speed. So he tried various speed tests around the house using his Bell Home Hub 2000 system and also using fast.com, which is a speed testing website. So the Bell tests were all absolutely consistent. Basically got 90 plus megabits per second anywhere in the house, standing beside the router to being several second floor rooms all over the place. But when he uses fast.com, he got a lot of variation. So worst was when he was upstairs, not downstairs in the basement, and speeds range from like 3 meg to 73. And 73 was when he was beside the router. So the question is, which of these results can he have confidence in? And Chris says,
I think he can actually have confidence in all of those numbers. They're very realistic, depending, and it all depends on what you think is being provided to you. So I suspect strongly that going through the Bell Home Hub 2000, it's actually running a speed test from the router, and it probably is, you know, from the router to something on the Bell network, probably not very far from their connection. And so, you know, you're going to get very, very consistent throughput and very high throughput. Personally, the other one that he was using, that is actually running from the client. And so that's realistic from whatever device you're connecting through to, you know, the broader internet. Now, I have used a number of those speed testing ones, and I always wondered a little bit, is anybody trying to game the numbers for some reason? And I decided to standardize on performance.cira.ca because it is run by CIRA, the Canadian Internet Registration Authority. And so I don't think that they have anything to gain by fudging numbers at all. Their app is quite nice, or their web page is quite nice. And one of the things that's kind of cool, too, is it lets you see what your neighbors are getting. So it'll bring up a map of where you are, and you can actually see different people are getting different speeds. So you can see how much people in your neighborhood are spending on Internet access, I guess, when you see that some are getting 6 megabit per second or, you know, some are getting gigabit speeds on their testing and things like that. So personally, I wouldn't bother with getting through the Bell Home Hub 2000 test because that's not telling you what you really want to know. What you really want to know is from your device itself through to on the internet, and I think performance.cira.ca is probably the best way to go.
And Tom is saying try Insider on PC. And a Wi-Fi analyzer on a phone, and signal strength is most important. And Lawrence says that he believes fast.com is from Netflix, and he thinks that would be an honest assessment.
I suspect that most of the ones that are out there that are providing speed tests are probably honest, but I like the idea of going to CIRA.
Okay, so here's another share from Stuart. An Android app that works as a hearing aid. Do you want to talk about that, Chris?
Sure. So I haven't tried it at all, but I just went to the Google Play Store, and you can just – I was going to paste in the URL directly to Sound Amplifier, but if you go to play.google.com and you just search for Sound Amplifier, it will be the first hit, and just watch for the one that is published by Google, that is written by Google, not by somebody else. Some of the benefits it claims, it can enhance audio from any Android device. You can use any headphones, whether they're wired or wireless, and they claim it improves listening clarity, allows you to filter, augment, and amplify sounds around you and reduce background noise, and it allows you to tune the left channel and the right channel separately. There is a review on YouTube where somebody went through, tried it out, and they actually have some live demos of how it sounds and so forth. So if you're interested at all in that, I recommend checking out the YouTube one. And then it is free. So, yeah, go to the Google Play Store, download it, try it out, and let us know what you think of it.
Okay, so that brings us to the end of the prepared questions. So if anybody has any other questions, shout up. But in the meantime, Claudette's noting that she ran the Bell speed test from a laptop, and the results were quite different, or very different, depending on the location in her house.
Oh, that's interesting. So I wonder if they have multiple ways of running the speed test, whether you can run it, you know, from the router, or you can run it from your device. Obviously, Claudette, it's running it from your device in your case, but the enormous consistency that was seen before, I really strongly suspect that particular test was being run from the router itself. So.
And Claudette had a question earlier in chat which we didn't get to. How successful is it to sync both Google and Microsoft on multiple devices? Is it necessary to connect Google to Microsoft and use the Microsoft Cloud?
I use Google Drive on multiple devices, and I have no problem at all with it. That I have it just syncing the Google Drive folder structure, which for me it's /users/ctaylor/Google Drive. So I have it syncing everything that is under there, and I have that on every one of my computers, and I have a few of the files within there are also synced to my phone, but not everything that is under there. I've got probably about five or six gigs now being synced, and I've had no problem with it at all. I suspect that Microsoft's OneDrive would be just as reliable. I don't have any personal experience with that. I suspect all of the ones that have syncing software that you can install on your computers, all of them should be just as reliable. Linda uses, what does he use, Linda? The,
what?
Yeah. But for syncing files to the cloud,
I use Dropbox usually.
Oh yeah, Dropbox, yeah.
Yeah.
And Dropbox is no problem. Its syncing seems to work reliably. So I don't know. Has anybody actually had issues with syncing cloud files around? I know there are some services. I use Degoo. And for its free service, you don't get a client that does automatic synchronization. Its charm is that they'll give you 100 gigabytes of space, but for free, but you have to do manual synchronization on that. But I think any of the ones that provide you with a client that you can install on your computer should work quite well.
So Claudette's saying she's been syncing files easily with Google, but now she has Microsoft. She wants to also sync with Microsoft, and she's just wondering if she can do both at the same time.
Should be able to. I know that Google Drive allows you to arbitrarily synchronize other folders as well. So you could choose your OneDrive folder structure and synchronize that. And I'm pretty sure that OneDrive likewise allows you to arbitrarily choose other folders on your computer to synchronize. So there should be no issue with synchronizing to multiple cloud services, I wouldn't think.
I would think it would just be slower, that's all.
Yeah, you're using up a whole bunch of bandwidth for duplicates. I'm not sure. Perhaps, Claudette, you could say why you feel a need to do that. I sort of figure my backups, I've got my original source on my hard drive. I've got local backups. I've got an offsite backup that gets done about once a month. And I have some files that are syncing to Google Drive. And I figure that's enough redundancy for me. I've never felt a need to synchronize with another cloud service. Is there a particular reason why you're going that route, Claudette? And Wendy says, occasionally you have to double-check files in Google Drive. Make sure you don't have a red X. Okay.
Yeah, I'll further clarify that. There have been occasional times when I've been on one computer and I'll access a file, and next thing I know, I go back over to another computer and I try to pull it down off the Google Drive, and it's the older version of it. And then when I go to drive.google.com, the web page, I'll see that there's that only one of them got backed up, and I'll have to go back to the other PC and notice that there's a red X in the actual drive folder on that particular computer, to the point where I've even had to uninstall Google Drive and start it all over again.
Did you ever try just restarting the Google backup and then sync or whatever it is?
I did. Yeah, okay. I did, and it didn't work. I had to actually start like brand new, fresh. But what I did was, before I did anything, I made sure that the newest file that was on the one machine was, I dragged and dropped it and put it in the web page version of drive.google.com.
Okay.
That way I knew it was in the cloud, so that way when I, you know, backed it up and everything, you know, and started all over again, both machines were updating correctly.
Okay. Google has a replacement for backup and sync or whatever. I got invited onto the beta program, but I'm surprised it's still beta, because I had actually tried this out a while ago. They have a new one called Drive File Stream, which for all intents and purposes looks to be the same as backup and sync. It's publicly available if you look for Google Drive File Stream. You can download it and install it. It seems to me to be the same, but because they sent me this invite to be part of the beta program, I presume that eventually it's going to replace backup and sync. But so I don't know. I personally have never had any problems with – well, I shouldn't say that. I've had occasion where the backup and sync app had to be restarted. So it stopped synchronizing for some reason. And it's happened to me once or twice. And so just restarting it was enough for me to get it going again. But that's the only issues that I ever had with it.
So B is asking, she says she has a 5 terabyte Seagate drive and used it as it came out of the box. And will it be NTFS or FAT32? And there's actually an easy way to check. If you load File Explorer and you right-click on a drive, so my data drive right here, I right-click on it and choose Properties, then it will tell me right here that the file system is NTFS.
Okay, great. Sorry, it's quite a dumb question, I realize.
No, not a dumb question at all. Yeah, and it can be really important, because if you are FAT32, then you could run into issues like the 2 gigabyte file size limit. So you could have tons of space. You try to copy a 3 gigabyte file and it'll tell you it doesn't fit.
Right.
So it's important.
So any other questions? We're a few minutes over. Otherwise, we'll go to the wrap-up slides.
Just wanted to make a little suggestion regarding the Zoom meeting for somebody that is senior. And I was just wondering if it would be a good idea to put an icon on a desktop where people can just click on it and start the Zoom automatically at the right place. And I found a link on the internet that lets you do that. And I thought it was probably an easier way for senior people just to have an icon with maybe call my son, for example, and have a picture of the son in question, for example.
Yeah.
So that way you can just, someone can just click on the icon of the desktop and have everything started automatically for them.
Yeah, that's a good idea.
Great suggestion, Gus.
Thank you.
Okay, so our next Q&A will be next week, of course, I mean next year, I guess. If you have questions or you want to answer some of the questions that Chris puts on the preliminary email or topics that you want to share with everyone, send it along to suggestions box. However, we are getting to the end of the year, so we have some New Year's resolutions for you. First of all, I will back up my computer tomorrow, right?
Tonight.
And we'll ask a question at the next Q&A session, and I'm going to find one that I can't answer. But remember, if Chris and I can't answer them, somebody else on the call has to. And then finally, I will share my favorite program and app with the group. And so you have to piggyback on what various people have been doing and keep this show alive.
So
and in the meantime, Happy New Year, everyone. See you next week, next year.
Happy New Year, folks. Thanks for showing up, and we'll see you next week.
Arrivederci.
Happy New Year.
Everybody, and thanks, guys, for doing this every week.
Oh, it's a slice.
Thanks a lot, guys.
Oh, happy good night, all.